All-Star closer Kenley Jansen, we have a question.
What's the best podcast of all time?
Baseball isn't boring, baby.
I'm Rob Bradford, and every single day I'm sitting down with the biggest names to show you this great game is the greatest game. It's my podcast. It's my passion. It's a cause I started more than 2 years ago and is now the most prolific national daily baseball pod there is. Another fact, so jump aboard the BIB Express. Follow and listen to Baseball Isn't Boring, presented by Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Another big ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court. Today, we're still awaiting rulings on student loan forgiveness and affirmative action, but Jill Hasday is a professor at the University of Minnesota. We reach out to her often on the Supreme Court, and she joins us live now on the John Schuster Coble Banker Hotline. Jill, thank you so much. My surprise at this, that these the justices continuously, at least over the last couple of decisions, have ruled, I guess, against what would be a conservative or Republican things. I guess it's surprising, but yet when I look at this ruling today, I guess, should I be more surprised that three justices actually voted for it?
Okay, so that's a great question. So I think of it as having two parts. First, many people think that the Supreme Court is about to overturn affirmative action, which would be a huge thing to hold affirmative action unconstitutional. And as most people know, the Supreme Court removed constitutional protections for abortion rights last year. Given that, many people think that the court is looking for opportunities to, in other areas, not rock the boat, because they're accused of disregarding their precedents. So some people think, you know, the court's looking for cases where they can affirm precedents.
Wait, Jill, so this is a PR decision?
Like a make-good call.
Right?
Well, I'm not going that far, but what I say in my con law classes is all the Supreme Court has is that we believe in it. It doesn't have an army. It doesn't have a budget. Uh-huh. It has to have popular support. And popular support for the Supreme Court, they do these polls, do you have confidence in the Supreme Court? People indicating if they have high or very high levels of confidence has dropped 20 points in the last 2 years. That's a free fall. So, and even though many of the justices, especially Alito, have gone around saying they don't care, of course they care. So I think they are looking for opportunities where they can uphold precedents that they can tolerate because they know there's others that they're sweeping aside.
So
I guess that's I would say that is the background.
Let's talk about this one. It was called Moore versus Harper.
Yes.
And what I'm reading, explain it, because it has rejected what's called an independent state legislature. Talk to us about how this affects, you know, voting rules and regulations.
Okay. So from one perspective, the idea that this was even a case before the Supreme Court shows how far to the right the judiciary has shifted. A number of Republicans had developed a theory called the independent state legislature theory, which was a new theory, and it interpreted the elections clause of the Constitution to say that only state legislatures could set rules, and state courts couldn't review them. So all the election clause actually says is that the times, places, and manners of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. Everyone agrees that this means, you know, the state legislatures can set rules governing federal elections, which as a policy matter is not necessarily the best policy, but that's in the Constitution. But this theory was that not only could the state legislature set the rules governing federal elections, but that state courts couldn't actually review those rules as if they're consistent with the state Constitution. There had been some hints in prior cases that there might be possibly majority support for this theory in the Supreme Court. And if so, it would have had very sweeping ramifications for elections because, for instance, there would be no state constitutional checks on gerrymandering. The legislature could just do what they wanted. But in Moore v. Harper, the court rejected that theory and said, no, everything a state legislature does is generally subject to judicial review, and this is no exception. I don't find this decision surprising, I guess, for two reasons. One, this theory is, to, in my mind, extreme and implausible. There's nothing in the elections clause that indicates these kinds of decisions would be exempt from judicial review as opposed to just the standard judicial review. And two, if the court is committed to anything, it's committed to a strong role for the judiciary. So it just seems implausible that the Supreme Court would accept a rule where, you know, courts can be cut out. That's just not their general mode of reasoning.
I just want to ask a follow-up also. I was reading that that it would also have empowered state legislatures to ignore the popular vote in their states. Talk to me.
Potentially. I mean,
yeah. And also, is that a reaction to this most recent election? And why would that even be a thing that they could ignore popular votes?
Right. I mean, phrased differently, if a state legislature could set election rules and they weren't reviewable by anything, then why couldn't they just do anything they want? Right. Like, our election rules are we're not going to have an election, or our election rules are we're going to have an election, but it doesn't matter. My side wins.
Here's some fake electors.
There you go.
Georgia actually did go for president.
That's the sign of how potentially extreme and disruptive this theory could have been. Because one reason it's important to have judicial review, the possibility of going to court, is that it actually keeps the legislature in line. You know, they don't do the crazy thing because they know the court is possibly going to review them, so you don't even produce the case. If they went into it knowing there was no possibility of judicial review, right, what would be the check? The only check would be pure politics, which might not, depending on the state, be much of a check. So I don't find this decision surprising. In some ways, what's surprising is that there was a possibility it would have gone the other way.
Yes, that's crazy. Yeah. I mean, now that you explain more of it, it's just insane.
I'm saying, is it more surprising that three actually voted for it?
Right. It's just... It just shows you how things have shifted.
We're talking to Jill Hasday, Distinguished McKnight University Professor, Centennial Professor of Law at the University of Minnesota. You mentioned this earlier. The court has no army. Its trust of the American people is what they need. Based on what we've read about Justice Thomas and now what we've read about Justice Alito, I mean, how on earth is there any possibility that a large portion of this country would have faith in this body?
We're at this interesting moment because there are two big stories about the Supreme Court unfolding simultaneously. And one is about their shift to the far right in a number of crucial areas of constitutional law. We've already seen the overruling of Roe, and I think most people anticipate that affirmative action, I mean, we'll see, but that affirmative action probably isn't long for this world. But simultaneous, we've seen the story about all the ethical issues. I think they're linked in the sense of why these ethical issues arguably also reflect a sense of I'm untouchable, I'm a genius. You know, anything I think is right is right. No one else can review me. They have overlaps, but I think the double whammy is a challenge to the court's legitimacy, and we'll see. So, for instance, when I was saying the court only has that we believe on them, you really can't overstate what Congress could do to rein in the court if it wanted to. And this is a long time ago, but in 1802, Congress canceled an entire session of the Supreme Court. You know, all the justices have is they have life tenure and salary protection, meaning their salary can't be cut. But that's really nothing, right? You can have salary, but you don't have air conditioning. Or you can have salary, but you don't have a court, or you don't have clerks. So what keeps the court in business is that there are norms where that would be inappropriate. We want to have a judiciary. And I think most people think those norms are, you know, we need an independent judiciary. That's really important to the functioning of a vital democracy. But at the same time, there is this, it's dangerous if the court thinks because of these norms, we will never be reined in. We don't have to worry about it. One mode in which this is currently being worked out is a congressional committee asked Chief Justice John Roberts to testify in relation to, right now the ethical rules don't, that govern other judges, don't govern the Supreme Court. They're advisory, and they wanted to have a hearing, you know, discussing it. And he refused to come. He said there's a separation of powers problem with me showing up in a congressional committee. But I just don't see why that would be. No other branch is immune. I mean, it's not like Congress can tell you how to decide, but the idea they can't talk to you about what ethical statutes Congress should pass, I think, is quite far afield. Mm. Plus, Roberts does go to congressional committees when he's asking for money for the budget. I mean, he shows up all the time.
We're speaking with constitutional lawyer Jill Hasday. Jill, you mentioned, and we don't know what's going to happen yet because we're still awaiting the Supreme Court decision about affirmative action, but you mentioned affirmative action may not be long for this country. What, briefly, would be some of the ramifications if affirmative action was struck down?
Well, so if the Supreme Court were to hold that affirmative action that takes race into account is unconstitutional, that would apply both to directly to any public university, which is because the government, state and federal government is controlled by the U.S. Constitution, but it would realistically apply to any private university that's receiving federal money because federal law says that Congress can't be giving money to places that racially discriminate. If the court says it's racial discrimination to have affirmative action, then federal money couldn't be going to private universities. Essentially, virtually every private university in the country gets federal money, either through scientific funding, which is almost entirely funded by the federal government, but also through student loans. So realistically, if the court has a clean statement that affirmative action always violates, race-based affirmative action always violates the Constitution, that realistically applies to every university and college in the United States.
One last question, Jill, and then we'll let you go. Thank you for the time. This is just a technical question. We've got the one ruling today. Will we get more rulings today, or when would we see that? Do they always have? I don't know enough. Do they always happen right away in the morning?
So there were two other smaller cases today, and there's a schedule. So the next 2 days is they'll be announcing opinions. They said on Thursday and Friday. And if they don't finish up, then it would be next week. They're almost always done by July 4th.
All right.
Quickly, Jill, is affirmative action only for universities, or does this apply to federal contractors or federal and state employees?
That's a great point. It would also be federal contractors. I mean, it would be no government agency would be able to engage in affirmative action if it's per se unconstitutional.
We may be talking to you again before the end of the week. Jill, thank you so much for the time again, as always.
Thanks for having me.
Jill Hasday, distinguished McKnight University professor, centennial professor in law at the University of Minnesota. 11:21. Coming up, not next segment, but in about 15 minutes from now, former Minneapolis Mayor R.T. Rybak will join the show. Tony Boza, who was the longtime in-your-face kind of brash Minneapolis police chief, passed away yesterday. And there's a lot of similarities between the Minneapolis Police Department under Tony Boza and the current Minneapolis Police Department under Brian O'Hara, and I want to get RT's thoughts on that. So RT joins the show in about 15 minutes from now.
Jill was fantastic. It was great to talk with her. So educational. And I think that, you know, people have to understand getting rid of affirmative action is not just a university bubble thing. It can also have – it will impact and can impact what it looks like for our federal workers, our state workers, and that means different legislation – like equal opportunity legislation will have to add in protections possibly about race or equality or diversity. And I don't know. It's just weird that we're still talking about this. I feel like affirmative action was such a 60s, 70s, even 80s conversation. And the fact that we're still battling this or still think it's unfair that some minorities might be given an opportunity that they didn't have in the past is a little sad.
And that's obviously we're going to have talk much more about that in the coming days, especially if that ruling comes down either Thursday or Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And we're getting texts about my political disdain for conservatives. And I'm like, what are we talking about? Like somebody challenging her on her, she's delusional and calling it a right wing or a right, far right court. You think Roe v. Wade gets overturned without it?
Mm-hmm.
Without a very right-leaning court.
It does not.
And by the way, again, we hear it all the time. Elections have consequences. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump was able to provide three justices to the Supreme Court. And he was able to do that because Mitch McConnell stalled on Merrick Garland at the end of the Obama administration. Right? Unprecedented movements. And we talked about it during the break about, okay, what's the rectification for that other than members of the court dying and
Or Congress changing it to a larger court, changing the rules of the court.
Right, and to me, that is just more damaging. It's like we keep changing the rules to get our team to, you know, a fair shot or whatever it is, whatever you want to call it, whatever delusion you want to call it.
But we haven't changed the rules yet, so that we haven't changed
a lot of rules. Okay, we've changed the filibuster rules.
We haven't changed the justices, of course. My big takeaway from her was how precarious this democracy experiment, and it really still is an experiment, is post-1776.
Has it ever felt more precarious than it has right now?
Well, again, I only know about what my lifetime
is. That's what I'm saying. In your lifetime.
Not in my lifetime. When she described the court, as she said, you know, what do they really have? They have their reputation and their salaries that they're entitled to. I mean, of course, they're entitled to they're constitutionally, they have to exist. We have to have a balance of power. But I hope that doesn't change either. I find great solace in the fact that there is a system of checks and balances. And sometimes that's the only thing that saves us. For example, like this redistricting law, the voter regulation law that just got struck down by the Supreme Court, you know, that local legislatures would have the opportunity to change redistricting laws willy-nilly without any oversight. That is dangerous because we're seeing what happened in Alabama and Louisiana, the attempt to change them and basically omit black people or sequester them to a very small area of the population. So their vote is only one-fourth
for
of
one
what the population. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
One congressperson. So the representation wouldn't really exist for them. And we know people are trying to do that. So this system of checks and balances, like we learn in civics, is so important. And her precariousness, her description of the precariousness was frightening to me.
11:29, actually 11:30 now, News Talk 830 WCCO. Traffic, weather, RT Ryback coming up, remembering Tony Boza and how it's that situation in the 80s in Minneapolis, kind of paralleling where we're at right now. Yeah. That's next. So Tony Boza was the Minneapolis police chief long before I got into the news business. So I was only slightly aware of Tony Boza as like this kind of brash police chief. And I remember he didn't talk like us. He didn't talk like us Midwesterners.
Like, yeah, well, he was born in Spain and from the East Coast, so he certainly did.
Who is this guy? Yeah. But so Tony Boza passed away yesterday, and I was reading the article about his obituary in the Star Tribune, and I was surprised to learn, and I do not remember that Tony Boza had a very brief run for governor, and his campaign chairman was one R.T. Ryback, who later became a Minneapolis mayor, and R.T. is on the line now on the John Schuster Coldwell Banker hotline. RT, thank you for joining us. Tony Boza, give me your impression of not only his life as a chief, but also his post-policing life and why, I guess, you decided to hitch your wagon in 1994 to Tony Boza as a possible gubernatorial candidate.
Well, actually, my history with Tony goes way back. I was the police reporter for the Star Tribune, and it was a period, I guess it was like 1979, 80, somewhere in there, where the police were deeply influencing city government, and had elected a mayor before that. So Mayor Fraser wanted some independent voice. So they hired this guy from New York, didn't know much about him, and I went over to City Hall to interview him. Well, I was used to talking to police.
Baseball season is heating up. Odyssey has you covered with the most entertaining coverage of your team. Stay locked in and in the know with the local voices you trust as they bring you unfiltered takes, recap games, react to the latest team news, and talk to callers. Listen to your favorite shows for free on the Odyssey app, odyssey.com, your smart speaker, or in the car with Android Auto or Apple CarPlay.
Police chiefs who, I guess the best way I can say it, talked like police chiefs, and in walks Tony, and, you know, he starts talking, and I started laughing, and he said, "What are you laughing for?" And I said, "Well, you don't sound like a police chief," because he was using words I'd never heard of, and English is my native language, it wasn't his, and he was talking about massive reform of the police department, which we all knew needed to happen, but assume he had the guts to do it. And so I covered him coming into a department and doing what I think people for years knew what needed to be done and still believe, doing the tough reform, not being controlled by the police federation, but instead having the guts to take on police officers when they did wrong and award those who did right. Anyway, so I was impressed with what he did. Fast forward a bunch of years later, and Tony said to me he wanted to run for Senate. And we said, no, the Senate race is already decided, but the governor's space is open. Why don't you do it? And what we said to him is, you know, Tony, you're pretty blunt speaking, so you've already alienated half the state and you haven't even started running. Let's not try to have you be Mr. Nice Guy. Be Tony Boza. Yeah. So basically, we said, say whatever the hell is on your mind. And my job was to follow Tony around the state and say what Tony really meant to say. And it was a hilarious campaign. And first off, Tony in crowds was pretty funny. He had this huge oversized head. And I only mention that because I said to him, you know, Tony, when you're talking to kids in a crowd, you can't like it loom up in them. He said, kids love me. I remind them of Easter Island. And, you know, with the big heads on the state. And so he just, you know, was going around the state saying whatever he wanted. And this was before Jesse Ventura and was sort of that with a little bit of a progressive twist. So he was leading in the polls. And then they asked him about guns. And he rightfully, in my mind, said we had to do something really dramatic about controlling the, at that time, obscene proliferation of guns, which, of course, has quadrupled since then. And it became a big controversy, and he plunged in the polls. I have rarely been as proud of a political campaign as I was of that one, because Tony was talking about taking the tough actions that could have saved thousands of lives of people who've been slaughtered in gun incidents. He was talking about reforming a police department that wound up being the police department of Derek Chauvin, and wound up being that sort of really blunt, honest politician everybody said they wanted. So he was not the classic politician, but he was what I thought we needed at the moment.
Do you see similarities? And RT, thank you for joining us. We're speaking with Mayor RT Ryback. Do you see similarities between Tony and current MPD chief Brian O'Hara?
That's a really interesting question. I'm going to not be neutral about this. I think Brian O'Hara is the best police chief we could ever possibly hire for this moment. So I am a huge fan of Chief O'Hara. I would say Chief O'Hara is more, I would say he's more respectful mm-hmm. of cops. Tony, I think, went over the top a little bit and really wasn't able to bring the force along, which, and there is something to that. I think both of them have the guts and the knowledge to know that there's deep reform needed and how to get it done. Chief O'Hara, more than Chief Boza, has had a track record of doing deep, deep reform in Newark. But I think they both are people who recognize that there is a better way to police and that the cops who are doing it right need to be rewarded and the cops who aren't need to get another job.
And I can see the parallels because they're both, for lack of a better term, the outsiders, right? They're both from the East Coast that said that the current mayor said, this is the person we need at this moment.
Yeah. I mean, Tony was more of a showman, let's face
right.
it.
Yep.
That, and he said, you know, some really hilarious things all the time, and that was sort of part of his charm, but also...
And some offensive things, though, right? There were some missteps.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, and, you know, when people say, gee, why don't politicians just be honest with me? Well, how about we're a little more rewarding of politicians when they are? And that's what I always thought about Tony. But I mean, he sort of went out of his way sometimes to jab people and entertain, and that was kind of part of the fun of him. But yeah, I think the analogy with Chief O'Hara only goes so far because he's a lot savvier player, I guess. Tony was savvy, but he didn't care to be that way.
Let's talk about the current state of Minneapolis. I know you were downtown for Pride. It was a super busy weekend in Minneapolis. And we talked on this show we led with, I think, on Monday, that Minneapolis wants, you know, 60% of commuters to be on a bike, a scooter, or not a car, basically. What do you think you see as the future of Minneapolis? Do you see it as a pedestrian city, more people living here, less offices? And how are we doing on the way to that path?
Well, you know, one of the things I go downtown every day. I work in the IDS Center and walk around a lot, so I think I have a pretty good handle on what's going on. I also covered it as a reporter. I worked with the downtown council. So people have this glorification of what downtown was. It used to have the best department store in the country. More than that, Dayton's was great. There aren't things like that anymore. But the quote-unquote glory days of downtown was really about 5 or 6 blocks, okay? A very strong area surrounded by parking lots and railroad tracks. Now the railroad tracks are the incredibly vibrant downtown riverfront. The North Loop was basically abandoned warehouses. Back then, the area by the Metrodome had nothing on it. Loring Park was just starting. The point I'm making is downtown is now a collection of villages. It is not 5 blocks. And when you hear that a good thing or a bad thing happened downtown, the first question is, in which neighborhood? The second thing is to recognize that no part of the country anymore is going to be supported just by office workers. There'll be a piece of it, but there are some buildings right in the core that are already being converted to housing. All around Minneapolis, the city there's incredible vibrancy in places that didn't used to be, primarily because of this intersection of work and office and the connection of all the different types of people we have in Minneapolis creates a lot of vibrancy. Go to 38th and Nicollet, which was never a great intersection. It's now probably got the best restaurants in town. Go to the North Loop, as I mentioned, go to other places. It's a combination of residential and office and housing. And I think the thing that people need to keep their eye on, too, is Minneapolis's population in general, and specifically downtown, has dramatically increased over the past couple of decades. And there are real attempts to get more density there. New York is New York because there are so many people who live there who can support shops, restaurants. If some of the office converts to retail, if more of the office population comes back, as is happening, and we stop doing city planning that has office over here and residential over there, it will resettle. So I think it's actually in an okay spot. It's not in a great spot, but, you know, people, there's nothing going on downtown. Well, check out last weekend, you know.
Yeah, it's hard to make those arguments, to continue to make those arguments. But you brought up a good point there about the people moving not only to downtown but Minneapolis. My question is, like, when you try to recruit, for lack of a better term, try to recruit people to live in Minneapolis, who are these people? Where are they coming from? Because you hear that all the time, too. I know this guy. He moved out of downtown or moved out of Minnesota. Who is moving to Minneapolis?
Well, there are lots of people. And first off, if you need any evidence, just drive around and look at the incredible number of parking lots that now have apartments and condominiums in them. But they're coming from all over the place. There's in migration and out migration, but for a couple generations, there's been a huge influx of young talent from small and mid-sized cities in the state. That's the one part that I hope doesn't continue. I think to keep vibrant Minnesota, a lot of these mid and smaller size communities, so much of the talent has come into the cities. Minneapolis benefits from that. St. Paul benefits from it. But I think there's been a hollowing out of parts of greater Minnesota, and I hope that is stemmed. One of the things, kind of an anecdotal thing, is there's something about Minnesotans that's like salmon. You know, salmon swim upstream to spawn.
We're very pink.
There's this, yeah, start to ask people, where couples, why they're here. Well, I was from New Jersey, but I met this woman from Minnesota. I was from Washington State. I met this guy from Minnesota. We have what appears to be, this is not scientific, there appears to be a disproportionate success rate Minnesotans have in convincing people to move back. You know, they go to New York for a few years, they meet somebody, they come back. And I, you know, I think that has helped us a lot. But, you know, every city right now is in a big transition. We did a big series. I run the Minneapolis Foundation now. We did a big series on with the Walker on where cities are going. It's called Abundant Cities. We got a bunch of stuff on our website about it. But cities are changing right now. And cities have gone through these changes before. It is okay to recognize that we're not quite sure where cities are going to go. If I had an office building that I owned, I wouldn't want to own it that much right now,
right.
But I would rather own it in a place where there are lots of people who live and work within proximity than bluntly on a parking lot somewhere in the exurbs. Office is going to be tough for everybody, but the ability to have live, work, play opportunities where more people can walk or not. You know, one way to describe cities right now is that to my parents, freedom meant having a car. To my kids, freedom means not being dependent on a car. That's not universal, but this is really the first generation of truly urban people we've raised. You know, my dad was from New Prague. My kid lives in the Wedge neighborhood, and he picked that because he's got four grocery stores. He can walk to myriad of restaurants. He can walk to Lake of the Isles. Yep. He can walk downtown. He can go to Loring Park. That is much more desirable now to a big part of the population. Okay. Not everybody, but we don't want everybody living here, you know.
Thanks, RT.
Keep out the reference.
Yeah, we're up against the clock. Thank you so much for the time. I know we started talking about Tony Boza, but we shifted gears, but we appreciate it. Thank you.
See ya. Bye-bye.
Thanks,
RT Rybak, former Minneapolis mayor.
Baseball season is heating up. Odyssey has you covered with the most entertaining coverage of your team. Stay locked in and in the know with the local voices you trust as they bring you unfiltered takes, recap games, react to the latest team news, and talk to callers. Listen to your favorite shows for free on the Odyssey app, Odyssey.com, your smart speaker, or in the car with Android Auto or Apple CarPlay.